Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, we are following up on two major national stories with a New Hampshire take on them. First, President Trump picks Brett Kavanaugh as his next nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk with UNH law professor John Graby about Kavanaugh and hear your reaction. Then, later in the program, the impact of trade battles in our state. Most New Hampshire manufacturers oppose the Trump administration's tariffs because they raise the cost of imports and provoke retaliation from trading partners. That is later this hour, but right now, we'll talk about the next justice for the highest court, possibly. UNH constitutional law professor John Graby is here, and let's hear from you too. What was your reaction to the news last night that President Trump picked Brett Kavanaugh? Who would you have preferred? What impact do you think Kavanaugh will have if he is confirmed? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. John Graby, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So President Trump announced his pick for the Supreme Court. He had some theater surrounding it, and last night, after 8 o'clock, he made his announcement.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person. Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
And then Brett Kavanaugh came out, he had his family with him, and he took some time to explain his judicial philosophy.
The motto of my Jesuit high school was men for others. I've tried to live that creed. I've spent my career in public service from the executive branch and the White House to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. I've served with 17 other judges, each of them a colleague and a friend. My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
Brett Kavanaugh speaking there. He's the latest Supreme Court nominee from President Donald Trump. John Graby, what can you tell us about Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, Brett Kavanaugh, and even in that short clip that you played, underscored that his approach to interpretation. So, in the cases where he is called upon to interpret a provision of the Constitution or a statute, that he is a textualist, that he is guided by the text, that he does not particularly care so much about, going beyond the text. In fact, he's ordinarily unwilling to look at things like legislative history and other indicia of larger purpose. This is a fundamental divide. It's a divide that splits, the wings of the court. The idea being, on the one hand, from those who have a textualist orientation, like Judge Kavanaugh, that we are a democracy. And that judges are not empowered to do anything more than to interpret the products of the democratic process. Whereas the, air quotes, because these terms are misleading oftentimes, but whereas some of the more liberal justices will take a broader view of text and will say, well, what problem was at issue in this case, and what problem was the legislature or the founders, what were they trying to solve? And that sometimes gives a little bit more leeway in terms of interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And how does he compare on, I guess you could say, the political spectrum to President Trump's first Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch?
Well, I've seen charts over the last couple of days from the 538 blog that have actually placed him over very, very close to Judge Gorsuch, who in his first term and a half on the court has proved to be quite conservative. He's been right there with Justice Thomas. Judge Kavanaugh has been a judge for a while. He's been a judge for over a decade, so he has written a lot of opinions, and there is a track record there, and he is conservative.
Mm-hmm. And how do conservatives view him?
I think, there's a range of opinions. I mean, there are some on the conservative side, I think, who were hoping for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who was seen as perhaps more likely to be allied with them on life issues, and in particular on the issue of whether or not Roe versus Wade or the central holding of Roe versus Wade should remain good law. I think there's a little bit more doubt in that crowd about Judge Kavanaugh and where he stands there.
Because Amy Coney Barrett was more explicitly anti-Roe v. Wade, right?
Well, she's written, she never came out and said that she would, that it should be reversed, mm-hmm. but she has said things in her academic writings that have led people to believe that it was likely that that is what her position would be.
And therefore it would be harder to get her confirmed.
But the Republicans hold all the power right now.
Yeah,
so,
that's true. Yeah, okay. Well, Brett Kavanaugh would be replacing Justice Anthony Kennedy. Right. So what was Kennedy's role on the court?
Justice Kennedy was famously known as the swing justice, especially after Justice Sandra Day O'Connor retired. Justice Kennedy moved to the middle of the court, and he was most often a conservative justice, but he was the most likely of the conservative justices to cast his vote with the more liberal faction of the court. And he, in fact, did so most famously in the cases involving the rights of people with same-sex sexual orientation, culminating in the decision to hold that there's a constitutional right to marriage. But he also was with the liberals on affirmative action and some other issues over the years.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with John Grabe about President Trump's decision to nominate Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, setting up a battle between Democrats and Republicans in the Senate. What do you think of the nomination, or what questions do you have about ideology or procedure? Our lines are open for you. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, John Grabe, what are some of the big issues that may come up soon that that Kavanaugh may have an influence on if he's confirmed?
Well, there are two issues that were before the court this past term that the court basically punted on that are very significant issues. The first is the question whether the courts can do anything about partisan gerrymandering, whether the Constitution puts some limits on the ability of legislatures to draw district lines in a way to favor the incumbent political majority. That issue was teed up in a couple of cases that were before the court, and the court basically decided not to decide. They decided that there was no standing for the plaintiffs, which is a requirement under Article 3 of the Constitution, that there be plaintiffs with an injury. But they sent the case back. The case didn't die. The case was sent back down for further analysis, further development of a claim of injury. Justice Kennedy had been the one member of the conservative bloc who had showed an open-mindedness. He had never gone with the liberals and said these claims can be adjudicated on the merits. But he had left open that possibility. His departure and his replacement by Judge Kavanaugh it likely signals that partisan gerrymandering claims are not going to, are not going to go anywhere at the court, in mm-hmm. my opinion. The other big issue that the court punted on was the Masterpiece Cake Shop case that received a lot of attention. This was the case of the baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple in Colorado and was charged with violating Colorado's anti-discrimination law. The question in that case was how far the scope of religious liberty extends. Does it exempt a business from having to comply with anti-discrimination law. The court in that case also basically punted. They basically said that in the proceedings below, there was anti-religious animus shown by members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, and it didn't make any new law. So the Baker won, but no important new legal ground was really broken in that case. But that's an issue that is also still percolating through the courts and could be back. And that's just two examples of many issues.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk of Roe v. Wade, and you just mentioned there needs to be a plaintiff with injury. So is there a plaintiff with injury in the pipeline for the Supreme Court to discuss Roe v. Wade about?
Well, I would think that state legislatures from states that would like to regulate or do away with abortion will fairly quickly take action to pass laws that are at odds with current precedent. In that case, it will not take much to find a plaintiff who is willing to challenge those laws. Supreme Court precedent has made for allowances in those cases because pregnancies only last 9 months and it takes longer for cases to get to the Supreme Court than 9 months. But there are so-called exceptions to what is known as the mootness doctrine that allows those cases to continue to be litigated even after the pregnancy ends. So, yes, I'm certain that there will be efforts to get that issue before the court again in the near future.
Our lines are open. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. If you've got a question about the new SCOTUS nominee, let's talk to Tom in Manchester. Tom, thanks very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Thanks. Appreciate you taking me on. Well, my comment is twofold. One, my concerns are that the nominee is going to really undermine women's rights and what you were just talking about, particularly in terms of eroding Roe versus Wade. But more, I think the most important concern I have is that he has demonstrated through his writing that he's reluctant and in fact is opposed to having the executive, in this case, Trump, investigated. And that really disturbs me, given the fact that the Mueller investigation is still ongoing and may end up being seen in some fashion at the Supreme Court. So that's a major concern I have. And I think that,
I was just going to say, Tom, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. And I wanted to add to those thoughts from Tom in Exeter, who wrote in to say, would Brett Kavanaugh be expected to recuse himself from any Russia investigation or Mueller investigation issues that might go before the Supreme Court? Tom in Manchester concerned about what this might mean for that investigation, and Tom in Exeter sort of asking about that as well. John Grabe, what do you think?
Well, I would be very surprised if he did believe that he needed to be recused. One of the interesting things that people don't realize is that there's really no code of ethics that binds Supreme Court justices. They're not covered by the code of ethics that cover lower court judges. But even if the code of ethics of lower court judges were to apply, the fact that in academic writing he expressed an opinion about the wisdom of the state of the law with respect to whether or not the president can be sued civilly or ought to be indicted, just because he expressed an academic opinion about a decade ago, that wouldn't be grounds for recusal. I mean, many people who go to the Supreme Court have expressed opinions on issues that could come before the court, and that doesn't disqualify them from opining on those issues.
We get a note from Katie regarding the discussion we just had on Roe v. Wade. Katie writes, "As much as I care about Roe v. Wade, worst case scenario is that the decision will ultimately revert to the states. Of far more import in New Hampshire will be how Kavanaugh views issues around gerrymandering and voting rights and limits on the presidency. Because if we don't have the right to vote, we can't get rid of biased gerrymandering. And if he doesn't believe that Trump can be forced to testify or be indicted, we have lost democracy and the rule of law in America." So commenting on a lot more than Roe v. Wade there, Katie, thank you very much. What do you think? That seems like some people are really afraid of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there was a lot of hope when the court took the gerrymandering cases last year that finally Justice Kennedy had seen enough. You know, it has really been a problem. It's hard to find anybody who thinks that the amount of partisan gerrymandering that's taking place right now is anything other than an affliction. The big question in the case is, you know, should the courts play a role? And is there some standard that they could come up with that would say, this is too much? Now, there's been a lot written on that recently, and there were standards that have been applied by lower courts. And for when Justice Kennedy basically decided not to decide and then retired, you know, there was some deflation. I don't know specifically of anything that Judge Kavanaugh has said or written that would shed light on his particular views on that, other than the fact that he, in his other jurisprudential views, is pretty solidly conservative. And the conservative position on this issue is that partisan gerrymandering claims are not susceptible of being adjudicated in courts.
Mm-hmm. If Kavanaugh is confirmed, President Trump will have filled two spots in the Supreme Court in his first term. Is that about average for a president, or is he moving at a faster clip than other presidents?
Well, it's pretty quick. Obama had two in 8 years. So Trump's had two in 2 years. Obama, of course,
almost had three.
But quite famously, his nomination of Merrick Garland was blocked in his last year.
And let's speak a little bit about process here, because some Democrats are trying to use the argument Mitch McConnell used and said, hey, wait a minute, we should wait until after the midterm elections so that the people can have a say. The Senate may have a different makeup after the midterm elections. Has it always been so political?
No, it has not always been as political as it is right now. But it has been building in this direction 4 years. I remember I was in law school. I was in my third year of law school when Robert Bork was nominated to the Supreme Court. And that was a riveting national fight. Excuse me. His nomination was also seen as the nomination that could lead to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. And the Democrats at the time pulled out all the stops and they defeated his nomination. And then a second nomination actually was withdrawn, Douglas Ginsburg. And that's the nomination that was eventually the spot that was eventually filled by Anthony Kennedy from the Ninth Circuit. And Anthony Kennedy, along with New Hampshire's own David Souter and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, famously, 4 years later, rolled back Roe v. Wade quite a bit, but preserved the essential holding of the case and held that there is a qualified right to terminate a pregnancy that the Constitution protects.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think this process is going to go for Brett Kavanaugh?
I think he will be confirmed. I think that there will be great effort expended to use this to rally energy heading into the midterms. But the fact is that the Senate, back with the Gorsuch nomination, did away with the filibuster for Supreme Court nominations. And that was in response to the Democrats under Harry Reid doing away with the filibuster for lower court nominations at a time when they perceived the Senate to be unduly obstructionist towards President Obama's nominees. So, you know, it's if you can get the majority vote in the Senate, you get it. And at the end of the day, I can't see any Republican senators breaking with the party.
Yeah. Well, John Grabe, thank you very much for sharing your insight on this. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
John Grabe is professor of constitutional law at UNH. And the conversation about President Trump's new SCOTUS nominee continues at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Coming up after the break, a conversation about another issue of national significance, tariffs. Some say we're in the midst of a trade war. How have tariffs imposed by the U.S. and by other countries affected New Hampshire businesses? Do you own or run a New Hampshire-based business? If so, how have the tariffs affected your business, or how do you think they will? Give us a call and share your story. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoi. Stay close.
Filling up the tank ain't what it used to be. Gone are the days when you were met with a smile and gasoline cost pennies. times have certainly changed, and while we can't send you back in time, we can help you fill your tank for next to nothing. Just be one of the early bird winners of NHPR's Summer Car Raffle, and you could drive off with $2,000 in gas gift cards to any station of your choice. Tickets are just $50 or get 6 for $150 at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're turning now to the subject of tariffs and their impact on New Hampshire. Let's hear from you. How do you feel about tariffs that the Trump administration is putting forward? How do they help or hurt the state's workers, businesses, consumers, the economy as a whole? We want to hear from you on this. Let's hear your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Before we get into that subject, I want to let you know about a program we're having later this week. This Thursday, we're kicking off our regional series, Going Local with the Great Northwoods. Every Thursday, we focus on what makes each region of the state unique, and we discuss the local challenges facing that region. Submit your questions and stories about your region at nhpr.org/exchange, and tune in Thursday to hear our discussion of the Great Northwoods. So on to tariffs, and here in the studio with me is Dave Juvet, Senior Vice President of Public Policy, Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, and also with us is Matt Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So maybe we should start by doing a little tariffs 101, and we should start with you, Matt. Are tariffs, are they typically imposed on one item in particular, like a washing machine, or is it on like a whole class of items? We'll say if it's not just a washing machine, maybe just all household appliances.
That's a great question. It's usually on a whole class of items, but not all imports that the U.S. brings in from the rest of the world. So historically, the United States has imposed tariffs on certain industries where we decide we need to protect the domestic producers for certain reasons, or where we think other countries are doing things that are unfair. That said, the devil is in the details on these things, as I think the conversation will reveal. The U.S. government classifies products that come into the United States in broad categories. There's a system of industry classifications, and yet there's a lot of judgment calls about which products fall into which categories. And so for any individual business, a lot of what companies in New Hampshire and across America are doing right now is just trying to ascertain, as a first step, whether products they might be importing as inputs for their companies, for example, fall under the tariff categories or don't.
Mm-hmm. And are tariffs typically put on goods from one country or a slate of countries all at once? All foreign steel, for example, or all foreign sugar?
Historically, it's been some of both. Right now, what the United States has been doing is levying tariffs, for example, on steel and imports on a large number of countries, although there was a lot of discussion over the past few months with a lot of our main trading partners about whether their companies would be exempt from those tariffs. But now, as of July 1, we're focusing on one country, China. So we levied about $34 billion worth of tariffs on that value of goods starting July 1. And in response to that same day, China responded by levying tariffs on $34 billion worth of imports that they bring in from the United States. So right now in the U.S., we've got a dynamic where it's both products on lots of countries, and we're increasingly focused on tariffs with China, thus the conversation a lot about a trade war having started.
Okay, and what is the relationship between tariffs and a trade war? Is that the single factor that qualifies a trade war, or are there other things involved?
Fortunately, we've had few trade wars when historians and economists look back. I think the most commonly cited one is what happened in the late 1920s and early 1930s. In the United States, we refer to these as the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. What happened here, because those two Congress people led the charge to have a lot of tariffs levied against a lot of countries and a lot of product categories, those tariffs and that tariff war didn't cause the Great Depression, but it definitely contributed to making it worse. So I think most people are trying to ascertain how bad of, in terms of how extensive the tariffs are and how much damage they cause to the United States to decide whether or not we are in a trade war. That said, I think the consensus is widely shared that we are now engaged in a battle with China on tariffs, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Great Depression, because of our two countries, among other things, are the two largest countries in terms of economic size in the whole world.
And Dave Juvet, I want to get your insight on this too, because from what Matt Slaughter is saying, it sounds like it's a hard situation to imagine that there are winners and losers. It sounds like they might just be losers, but you tell me, who's winning, who's losing when it comes to the existence of a trade war and tariffs?
Yeah, well, there actually are winners and losers, but I think ultimately there's more losers, which is why the Business and Industry Association is not supportive of these tariffs. And although Professor Slaughter mentioned China now, there's a strong concern that this could escalate and become a trade war with some of our most important exporting partners, Canada and the European Union and perhaps others. Here's how it creates winners and losers. If you have place a tariff on something like steel, for example, which makes importing steel much more expensive. If it's a 25% tariff, you've just increased the price of imported steel by 25%. Well, that tends to benefit domestic steel manufacturers because now they can sell their product potentially for less than what imported steel would cost. But I think in the long run, everybody ends up losing. And here's why. Although it might initially help domestic steel manufacturers because their product becomes more competitively priced, it's still more expensive than the users of that steel are used to paying or want to pay. So, for example, the auto industry will cut back on production because the cost of steel has dramatically increased. And that means less sales for the domestic steel manufacturer. So it can escalate. And it can escalate in ways that people often don't anticipate.
Mm-hmm. One might think that the steel tariff might be effective insofar as other countries don't also apply steel tariffs for exported American steel.
Well, that's one of the problems that the BIA and the U.S. Chamber have identified. This acts as a constricting force on international commerce, and New Hampshire and most other states around the country, a lot of their economic activity is based on exports. So if you're initiating a policy that tends to reduce the ability to export, it is not good for your local economy.
Matt Slaughter, does that all ring true to you?
It does. I think Dave summarized very well the fundamental policy challenge, which is, on net, the United States is harmed by these tariffs. I think the historical record is very clear. They tend to create some winners in the short term, but there's an awful lot of companies and ultimately the workers that get harmed by the uncertainty that's created by these tariffs and the direct escalation in costs. I think a good historical reference point is in 2002 and 2003, the United States decided to levy substantial tariffs on imports of steel. And a lot of research has been done that showed for a period of time, there was a slight increase in the number of people in the United States working in steel-producing companies. But the net cost to the economy of all the steel users downstream was so large that the cost per job created over that period of time was estimated to be several hundred thousand U.S. dollars. And I think that speaks to the fundamental policy question, which is I think many people, the president and others, want America to create millions more good-paying jobs. But the historical record and research shows very clearly the best jobs in America tend to be jobs that are connected to the world, as Dave was saying.
Mm-hmm. America may impose tariffs, but other countries do it too. Are there other countries that have been generous users of the tariff?
Historically, that's definitely the case. I think you look at agriculture, for example. Dozens of countries around the world, and today they still do, offer substantial protections against imports of food products. There's a longstanding thought in many countries, either the political scale of farmers is outsized, and so they, in the political process in those countries, generate more protection, or there's just a broader concern of maintaining food security. So one of the challenges, though, that the United States is facing, we in the past couple of years have decided, for example, to talk about renegotiating the NAFTA, as Peter said, our longstanding free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. We withdrew from an agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we had been negotiating for many years with 11 other countries. These other countries aren't standing still. They're signing free trade agreements among themselves. The other 11 countries in the TPP, for example, continue to negotiate and have ratified a treaty to eliminate all trade barriers among themselves. The need to kind of create jobs that are connected to the world that tend to be the good jobs, one of the challenges is The more we're focusing on levying new tariffs and other forms of trade protection, the more we're missing the opportunity of being involved in these new trade agreements that many other countries are involved in.
And when other countries impose tariffs on the U.S., how does the U.S. typically respond?
Well, what we tend to do historically is we tend to either one-on-one with those countries or through the multilateral organization called the World Trade Organization, try to negotiate a reduction in those trade barriers. As Dave said, when we import tariffs, oftentimes, and we're seeing this in real time today, those countries respond by levying their own trade barriers. That makes it harder for exporters in America. So we have historically tried to work through the World Trade Organization to bring down those barriers according to the broad rules of trade that countries over decades have agreed upon, that the U.S. played a major role in taking the lead and creating those rules. Right now, we're not doing that. That's part of what makes people so uneasy about what might be the next steps in the days and months ahead and whether this trade skirmish or trade war will get worse.
Listeners, we're speaking with our guests today about tariffs and trade and how tit-for-tat tariff hikes between the U.S. and other countries may affect New Hampshire businesses. What questions do you have about this subject? What's your experience? Do you work in an industry that may be impacted by tariffs? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Dave Juve, when an industry is protected by tariffs, what does it often do when it's under that protection?
Well, the reason for the protection, if you want to use that word, is to try and spur growth in that industry. But again, I question whether this is a long-term plan that can work. Part of the problem with, when we talk about a trade war is to realize exactly what that is and how it can escalate. It can not only escalate in terms of higher and higher tariffs on specific products, but it can draw in other countries and other products are added to the tariff list. And this has immediate impacts. And I'll give you an example from what some people are calling our trade war with China. It turns out a lot of seafood that is either manufactured or caught in New Hampshire ends up in China and in Chinese restaurants. And the imposition of tariffs by the Chinese on these products is having an immediate effect on those that are involved in the seafood industry in this state, and that's just one example.
Well, what are the effects?
Well, the effects are that their product is either not competitively priced in China any longer, so the consumers, the people who are buying that product, either food distributors or restaurants in China, are either choosing to get that product from somewhere else where the tariff isn't being imposed, or they're just deciding to do without. And so the production falls. Now one effect, immediate effect, might be the price of lobsters in New Hampshire will drop because the people who are providing that product need to find customers to replace the ones they've lost. But the long-term effect is not good.
Mm-hmm. And are there any industries at risk of collapsing because there's a tariff that may just put too much strain on it?
Well, history will tell us that can happen, but this is a long-term there are long-term ramifications.
And when you say long-term, do you mean like a year, 5 years, 10 years?
It could be a year or mm-hmm. more. New Hampshire, in terms of our durable product manufacturing, is we don't tend in this state to manufacture products. Like, we don't build refrigerators or we don't build cars. What we do a lot of in this state is component manufacturing. We manufacture the things that are used by other manufacturers to make refrigerators and to make cars. So if there's something that causes a slowdown in the automotive industry, for example, where because of the price of steel, auto manufacturers are cutting back on their production, that has an effect on manufacturers here in New Hampshire that are manufacturing car parts. All of a sudden, their primary customers, whether it's Ford or BMW or whomever, are not ordering the same amount of parts, or they may just stop ordering completely. And so, the initial impact is on the automotive industry. The secondary impact is on manufacturing here in New Hampshire that provides components to the auto industry.
Mm-hmm. What are New Hampshire's biggest imports and exports?
Well, we import a lot of everything. We import a lot of clothing. We import wood products. We import food. We import steel. We import a lot of things. In terms of exports, we export technology, software, components for high technology components, biotechnology. It runs the gamut.
The imports you're mentioning seem to really affect us on our day-to-day life: food, clothing.
Well, that's the other thing, that where this puts a strain on the economy is if you have products like clothing, for example, and even at big box retailers where you would traditionally think clothing is lesser expensive, if their product is coming from China, it could become more expensive, and all of a sudden that impacts the average person on the street. The average person on the street that may not have any role in importing or exporting at all of a sudden is facing higher prices.
Dave, the Business and Industry Association said almost $30 million worth of New Hampshire exports are, quote, threatened. So what does that mean, threatened? Threatened by what exactly?
Well, threatened by if tariffs are placed on our products that make them less competitive in the world marketplace, they won't be sold. And that will affect, that'll have a direct impact on the companies that are trying to sell those products or manufacturing those products. It has a secondary impact if it leads to job losses and higher cost for consumer items in the state. You know, a lot of people don't realize this in New Hampshire, but we are a manufacturing-based state. Manufacturing represents the most important component of the New Hampshire economy, although it's not one that you see in the way you see, for example, tourism. But it's extraordinarily important to our economy, and there are almost 200,000 jobs in New Hampshire that are either directly or indirectly related to exporting. So if there is something like a trade war that causes a constriction in that activity, it will have an economic impact on the state.
And we get this note from Otto, who sent us an email. And Otto wrote in to say, I work for a New Hampshire manufacturing company that uses high-speed steel tools that we buy from overseas companies. Quite frankly, companies in the U.S. do not manufacture the quality or quantity of steel that we need here. Following the 25% increase, our U.S.-based vendor has actually decided to decrease their presence in the tool steel industry in order to shift production capacity to other industries and essentially drop our needed product line. Otto continues, so now we will be ordering more from overseas at that 25% increase. Really quickly, Dave, it seems like the likely outcome is pass on the cost to the consumer.
That is the only option.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're talking about tariffs in this part of the program, and we'd love to hear from you if it's affected you as it's affected Otto, or if there's a different way it's affected you. We want to know about it. Give us a call to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You could also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello, filling in for Laura Kanoi today, and we will be right back.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Kanoi today, and we're talking about trade tariffs and their impact on New Hampshire. And let's hear from you. How have tariffs impacted you as a worker or a business owner? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 6477. We're speaking with Matt Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, as well as Dave Juvet, Senior Vice President of Public Policy for the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. And also joining us for this part of the program, we've got Mark Carter. He is President of American Steel Fabricators. Mark, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Mark, since you know steel inside and out, we just got a comment from Otto, who said that, you know, following the 25% increase, one U.S.-based vendor actually decided to decrease their presence. So now, as a result, he'll be ordering more steel from overseas at that 25% increase. What do you make of Otto's story?
I'm not sure that I follow that or that that makes sense. If he's paying more, I guess I wasn't aware of that kind of behavior.
Well, tell us a bit about the American Steel Fabricators. What's business been like for you?
Business is good right now. The economy is good. Construction is strong. And, correspondingly, our business is doing well.
And what's your view of the president's tariffs?
Well, I think that the president is attempting to renegotiate the current trade circumstances where the United States is in a has been involved in a trade war that it's not has not been fighting and has been placed in a disadvantaged position in his view, and the president ultimately would like to have free and fair trade for everyone, and that certainly does not exist right now.
Describe how it's unfair now.
Well, there are tariffs, for example, on U.S. auto and thus United States steel in almost all major trading nations with the United States, and certainly, for example, the EU or China.
And so to make it fair, the United States and the president should increase those tariffs to make them equal or outpace them?
I think there are probably two things, again, to restate. I think the idea is to renegotiate by threat of tariffs on the products of other countries to renegotiate America's position so that tariffs and trade barriers can be eliminated altogether. I believe the president just said in the last few days that he proposed that all tariffs and all trade barriers be eliminated to our G7 partners, and they then suggested that the subject be changed.
Some economists have warned that an escalating trade war might cause a recession. Is that something that you're concerned about?
I think that I am, and I don't think that I want to be cast in the role of supporting trade wars, which I think everyone recognizes are destructive for everyone. But I think the president feels that there are industries, the steel production industry being one of those, that a nation must have in order to survive. And he's concerned that in steel and other areas in America that we're losing those industries that are vital to the country as a whole.
So what will you be watching for in the months ahead?
I expect that the president's right in his estimation that no one really wants a trade war, that no one really wins in a trade war, that we haven't been fighting it, and when we start, that the countries who have put us in a disadvantaged position will recognize that discretion is the better part of valor for everybody, and we'll come to a healthy balance that improves America's lot in the world.
Mark Carter, President of American Steel Fabricators, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We're speaking with our guests today about tariffs and trade and how tariff hikes between the U.S. and other countries may affect New Hampshire businesses and consumers. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to the phones and talk to George in Berlin. George. Thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, gentlemen. Yes, my comment is this. India, many years ago, put a 50% tariff on tools, all tools coming in, American tools in particular. All right? Now, you only have to go to the local hardware store and see that when you want to buy an axe, I'd say 75% of the axes you're going to run across are made in India. My point is simply this. We are the only nation that practices free trade, and you only have to look at the over probably up to 60,000 factories and industrial companies that have shipped overseas. Now, we have a pulp mill up here, and we also had some tissue machines in Groveton in the North Country. And what happened was that they went to Brazil and Vietnam. Now, we've never got off our knees up in this community. We have a number of prisons in place now, but prisons don't pay taxes, and they don't make very viable jobs. And what I'm saying is that if we as a people and as a country are against slave labor, child labor, and environmental catastrophes that are the byproducts of other nations undercutting us in any manner of unfair ways, but we allow them to showplace their goods, we're accomplices. And I think we only have to look at all of the dwindling industries. This is putting on the brakes from 99 miles an hour to 92 miles an hour. And I think more is going to follow. And it's the only way we're going to rebuild our country and be safe in economically, militarily, and also just for the families of working people.
Well, George, thanks very much for your comments. Really appreciate it. And want to turn to Matt Slaughter for a response on that. There's so much to unpack in what George had to say. But Matt, maybe start with the idea that, you know, if we lose a trade war, as George was suggesting, that we ultimately lose jobs, which is what he argues what happened to some extent in the North Country. What do you think, Matt?
So George is exactly right about a deep issue that needs addressing, which is as large as the gains have been to America of international trade and the related other forces of globalization like investment and immigration and the flow of ideas, those gains do not directly accrue to every single worker in every single community and every single company. And so the big policy question that, frankly, our country needs to address much more openly and aggressively is how are we going to address the pressures that globalization and the related forces like technology innovation create? Like the problem that Otto, an earlier caller, rightly pointed out is when you start to do things like levy trade barriers, and as Dave articulated earlier, you start to create winners and losers. And the historical evidence is very clear that on net, the country actually loses, not gains, from those trade barriers. So the deeper question that would be great to have people in Washington, D.C. start talking about is how do we strengthen the social safety net and how do we actually build more ladders of opportunity so that more people, when these dynamic economic forces, which have been present for generations and will be present for generations, how can more individuals find the reskilling, the new opportunities to connect with the new jobs that these forces are always creating?
And Dave Gervais, what do you think of George's comments?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent he's right. I mean, the reality is the United States is a consumer nation, and part of being a consumer nation is we are always going to want to find products at the least expensive price. And if the result of a trade war is that either we're cutting off those products or making them more expensive to import into the country, ultimately, it's going to be the consumers in this country that pay that price. Now, some may argue that's a price worth paying if it means that it brings the manufacturing of axes back to the United States. But it remains to be seen, you know, at a macro level, the impact it'll have on the economy if the way we consume goods is reduced.
You say we're a consumer country that's opposed to a manufacturing kind of company, a country rather?
Well, I think we're both, but I mean, the reality is with the globalization of the economy, including the U.S. economy, a lot of U.S. companies have moved manufacturing to other countries because the cost of labor is so much less. Now, if there's something that happens to that equation that causes those products that are being manufactured in other countries to now become more expensive, and manufacturers make the decision to start manufacturing those products in the U.S. again, they still have to deal with the issue of the cost of labor in this country and the cost of electricity and the cost of a lot of other things that go into to manufacturing. And ultimately, the price of the product will be more expensive.
In theory, could tariffs be raised by the United States government to such a point that it does encourage companies who have either left the country to come back or for new companies to come to the United States?
In theory, I think that's exactly the theory.
But in practice, maybe not.
Well, I think the counterbalance to that is the cost of the product being more expensive means that less of that product will be sold.
Hmm. We're speaking with our guests today about tariffs and trade. There's still time for you to get your questions in if you have them. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And let me ask you, Matt Slaughter, a little bit about the politics of this. How do the state's leading politicians feel about trade? Are there typical partisan differences here?
Great question. What's interesting is I think the breadth of concern about globalization has blurred the more traditional party distinction, which is Republicans tend to be more supportive of free trade and open borders, Democrats voicing a bit more concerns. Think back to the last presidential election in 2016. The leading candidates in both parties were actually voicing pretty strong anti-globalization sentiments, and President Trump, I think, is manifesting that. I think that just speaks to, again, the breadth of legitimate concern about how do we create more good jobs at good wages in America. That's an American concern. It's not a Republican or Democratic concern. But again, the paradox is trying to address that concern through trade barriers or, goodness forbid, trade wars is only going to harm on net the whole country and aggravate the kind of problems that underlie the concerns. There's got to be a different focus, ideally, from our New Hampshire politicians and elsewhere on how do we build skills. How do we retrain? How do we create an environment where lots of companies can create the kind of good jobs everyone's seeking?
And Matt, you mentioned just a short time ago something about a social safety net needing to be strengthened a bit. How might the social safety net insulate Americans from the negative impacts of a trade war?
Great question. Take unemployment insurance, which is one of the main labor market supports our country has for people in transitions from one job to the next. That program was designed literally in the 1930s, and it was designed at a time where most layoffs that happened in America were short-term layoffs for people that tended to go back not just into the same industry but to the same company. But today, given the forces we've been talking about here, there are so many more causes of job transitions. In fact, every hour that America is open for business, about 30,000 jobs are destroyed in the U.S. economy. Now, fortunately, about 30,000 or a little bit more are created every hour as well. But there's just a tremendous amount of dynamism in the U.S. economy across all industries, all states, all communities. It would be terrific if we could rethink a way to provide, frankly, better funded and more modern ways to support the kind of job transitions that workers in America are facing.
Let's take one more call and talk to Bob in Dover. Bob, what do you think?
Oh, well, I agree basically with George, and previous caller. I think he hit the nail right on the head. But added to that, that the major companies in China are also nationalized and subsidized, and as he pointed out, use forced labor oftentimes. So, I mean, that disadvantage needs to be addressed too. God knows, I don't know how, but it should be.
Thanks very much, Bob. So, yeah, that's something we haven't explicitly talked about yet, but the fact that other countries have, we'll say, different standards of labor, and then that lots of other countries have nationalized industries. And, Dave, that might really make them sort of advantageous for those countries, but not so much for us.
Well, it does. It certainly makes it difficult to compete, and we all understand that. And part of competition means we need to innovate and find new and better ways to manufacture, less expensive ways to manufacture, and newer things to manufacture, relying on our technology expertise. There's no question that these disadvantages are out there, and we all understand that. Again, the issue is how best to deal with that, and to recognize that as much as we would like to see those disadvantages eradicated, as consumers in this country, eradicating those, if we were able to, would be a corresponding reaction to that, which is the price of products that we consume will go up.
There's a cost.
There is a cost, and maybe as a country we're willing to bear that cost, but you have to remember that there is a balance.
Final thought, I'll get it from you, Matt Slaughter. What should we be watching for as the United States continues to engage with tariffs in this manner?
In the immediate term, we should watch to see whether, in particular, President Trump and President Xi in China and the leaders of Canada, Mexico, the Europe, whether there start to be constructive conversations among them or among their key deputies to stop the increase in tariffs and other trade barriers and the discussion of those, and start to have some conversation about ways to reduce those barriers and address in a healthier and more productive way the concerns that Bob just called out. There's a number of legitimate concerns that the U.S. rightly has about the trade practices of other countries. Historically, through negotiations is the way that we tend to resolve those problems, not through wars.
Matt Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Dave Juvet, Senior Vice President of Public Policy for the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire, thanks to you as well for being here.
Thanks so much.
Also want to thank Mark Carter, who joined us for part of the program to talk about tariffs. And thanks to John Graby, Professor of Constitutional Law at UNH, for helping us understand President Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court in the first part of the show. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our intern is Abigail Sleeper. The conversation continues at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Knoy. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.